Well, good morning and welcome to the 11th weekly To Know Insights call on the impact of COVID-19. One man has dominated the news this week, Dominic Cummings. The person who's supposed to be his boss, Boris Johnson, has expended huge amounts of political capital to keep him in place, calculating that his value to the government is greater than the impact on popularity. And that impact has been seismic, major drops in the Conservative Party and the Prime Minister's ratings. It's also spawned an entire subgenre of social media satire, including my personal favourite, Paddy McGuinness rewriting the lyrics to Is This the Way to Amarillo? Check it out after this call. Meanwhile, plans to loosen the lockdown have been rushed forward, including non-essential shops being opened on June the 15th. Lurking behind all the political shenanigans remain serious questions about how we protect the economy and jobs, and how we stop a second spike. As ever, we've got another amazing panel to talk us through all this. Lord Jim O'Neill is a former Treasury Minister and former Chairman of Goldman Sachs Asset Management Division. He'll give us his thoughts on the economy. Lord Andrew Cooper is the co-founder of Populous and former Downing Street advisor. He'll share his insights about public attitudes towards the crisis. Amber Rudd is a regular on the call, Teneo Senior Advisor and former Home Secretary, will analyse the political situation in the UK. And Wolf Pickerley, co-president of Teneo's risk practice, will analyse trends in the handling of COVID-19 around the world. But before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the top right-hand side of the screen, you'll see the chat function. Please use that to send your questions to me, and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on the call, please hang up now. This isn't intended for broadcast or publication in any way. So that's done. Let's get to it. And let's start with you, Jim. For years after the banking crisis, we were warned about being exposed to too much debt. It's now astronomic. So why shouldn't we be afraid about that?
Nice, easy question to start with there, Craig. Thank you. I'll come back to that. I wanted to make two broader points of the context or the circumstances for the UK from a global perspective. many years ago, before my asset management time, when I was chief economist of Goldman, I presided over the creation of a sustainable development index for about 180 countries about long-term sustainable growth. And I looked at the last one they published in the first couple of weeks, and surprise, surprise, the countries that were the 10 best scoring countries in the world on that index then, and actually still now, had nine of them had the lowest deaths to population ratio around the world. The top three were Singapore, Hong Kong, and South Korea, and the rest were primarily Northern European countries. And the UK was not on one of those, neither were the US. And I say that because, seen from a 40,000 feet perspective, the UK's performance through this is not overly surprising to me, as disappointing as it seems from a global perspective. Second thing to say, linked to that and coming closer to your real question, correlation of performance in such indices is generally pretty well correlated with performance on productivity and the amount of shared wealth. And we know that the circumstances that have faced the UK even before the 2008 crisis, and the one that the government you were part of and I joined, had the same issues. And the whole overall productivity performance in the UK actually deteriorated the past decade even further, despite a very different approach and policy. So the third point is the real key, in the spirit of not letting a crisis go to waste, is actually trying to address those issues more, because unless we can boost the growth performance of the economy, what we try to do deliberately about debt is to some degree a little bit incidental. But in that regard, and I've been featured in some media discussions about this recently, one of the things I think, in the spirit of never letting a crisis go to waste, that this government should do, and it would be a very unconventional thing to a Conservative government, with the possible exception of this particular leader. It'll be interesting to hear what Amber might say about this. The easy way of explaining it is to set up some kind of domestic version of a sovereign wealth fund. There's been times this government likes to have flattering comparisons with the future of Singapore, but a more applicable one than the one of being obsessed about low taxes is they have an institution called Temasek, which is a significant investor in domestic Singaporean businesses, and by the way, has been generally pretty successful. And I think now is an opportunity for the UK to consider doing something like that rather dramatically to help manage this. And then the other thing which I shared with you in advance of the call, and I published on a couple of weeks ago, is I think there's a great opportunity to give the Bank of England a different remit. For much of the period of inflation targeting, a lot of focus on the concept of nominal GDP targeting, which is essentially trying to target inflation and growth. And there were various technical reasons I won't bore people about, I'm sure many know about why it's never happened. But now the circumstances are almost perfect to do such a thing, where it wouldn't guarantee a stronger economic recovery, but it would certainly increase the probability, because it would oblige the bank to try and boost nominal GDP, which in itself would by definition help to manage debt to GDP coming out of this mess. I could elaborate at great length on any of those points, but in the interest of time, I shall stop there for now.
Thank you, Jim. That was fascinating. I'm just going to say to people who are on the call, just check if your video camera's on. A few of you keep popping up, and you might want to switch off your video camera because we can see what you're doing as well. But I'm going to come to Andrew next. We were going to spend some time getting you to dig in a bit deeper into what the public actually thinks, and you'll come to that in a moment. But inevitably, the impact of the Dominic Cummings saga is going to be cutting through in terms of polling. So can you begin by explaining where we are on that?
But it seems to be the case that the government that Dominic Cummings himself and Boris Johnson were hoping and assuming that this would be one of those inside the bubble issues that doesn't cut through with the voters. And the evidence from the polls is that they're wrong about that. But the public are very engaged on this issue and they care. The polling done since Dominic Cummings' press conference on Monday shows that over 70% of public think that, based on what he said, he did break the government's lockdown rules, and almost 60% of people think that he should resign. And this saga has coincided with and seems to have triggered a very steep decline in favourability of the government and in public support for the government's handling of the week that the lockdown started. Almost 70% of people in the UK said that they had a favourable view of how the government was handling it. And by Monday, that had dropped to 40%. And the approval rating for the government was 53%, 8 weeks ago, and is now zero. Another way of looking at this is to give us some context, is to look in the context of what's happening in other countries. We see a very similar pattern everywhere. At the beginning of the crisis, was a kind of running around the flag effect. Lots of people feel when there's a big crisis that's happening, which obviously isn't caused by the government, it's not the government's fault. People tend to rally behind governments and leaders. But in almost every country around the world, you saw a big increase in support for governments and leaders. The decline in that support is much steeper and much faster in the UK than it is are the lowest. There are a few countries which have lower approval for their governments, but they started much lower in the first place. So the speed and trajectory of the decline will be causing huge, huge anxiety, I would think, in Downing Street. Boris Johnson's own favourability will get boost when unfortunately he was taken ill. There's a lot of public sympathy, big surge in his ratings as Prime Minister. Had a 66% positive rating 8 weeks ago, a net rating of plus 40. As of this weekend, his approval rating is minus one. And I don't think we've hit the floor yet. if we compare that with the new Labour leader Keir Starmer, a lot of voters haven't seen enough of him to have a view. So about 40% of people said they don't really have an opinion, they don't know what they think. But among those who do have a view of Keir Starmer, his rating is plus 12. There's a 13% gap opened up in favour of the Labour Party. If we look at voting intention, obviously it's over 4 years till the next election. But the average Conservative lead over the Labour Party since the general election up to the start of this coronavirus crisis was around 20%. A week ago, that had dropped down to about 15%. Today, that lead is down to 6%. But it's still a lead. The speed with which that lead is being eroded will be causing huge concern in Downing Street.
Okay, Andrew, that's fascinating. I'm sure we're going to return to that in a lot more detail coming up. And also, I think in the Q&A, people will be interested in hearing from you about the impact of this on people and how they're reacting. But I'm going to come to Amber next. You were a very senior cabinet minister. Did you experience anything like this? Have you seen anything like this before? You're on mute, Tanda, Amber.
Can't believe I did that. I've never seen anything go on like this in the way it has been going on. You know, having been in the centre myself of a couple of high dramas in cabinet in my role, I know that if you're the centre of the story for a number of days, you have to go. And in my conversations with Conservative MPs and indeed cabinet ministers, everybody wants this government to succeed. They want Boris Johnson to succeed. They recognise the terrible difficulties that we're in trying to get out of this virus with the lockdown, with the stimulus that's going to be needed for the economy, etc., etc. And yet they can see support draining away because of Dominic Cummings. And this is kind of, you can see that Boris is absolutely wedded to Dominic Cummings. He thanks, he holds him. He thinks he has him to thank both for getting Brexit through, for doing the strategy with him at the end of the last year, which then led to effectively a Remain Parliament supporting a general election. So it created the Brexit Parliament. And he's absolutely joined at the hip with him. So in my view, Boris is going to carry on holding on to Dominic as much as he can. And I guess that's the proviso, as much as he can. And then it's over to the Conservative MPs who have one by one been coming out saying this is not sustainable. Obviously, the cabinet we have seen be very supportive of Dominic. Most of them owe their positions to Dominic's thumbs up. I think that the Chancellor, even though he's done a good job, basically works for Dominic because it was Dominic that got rid of Sajid. So Dominic is not an average special advisor. He is the Prime Minister's right-hand man. And in many ways, I think the Prime Minister has concluded that he needs him. He really needs him to continue. But if this continues and more Tory MPs come out saying he must go, it is going to create an impossible situation for the Prime Minister, because the MPs, having said publicly, and this is another consequence of coming out publicly, is once you've said publicly, I oppose this man, he needs to go, your constituents will hold you to it. There are hundreds of letters coming into MPs at the moment that are furious with them. That whole theme, which MPs and Tory strategists worked so hard to overcome, that the Tory party is just for the elite, that the Tory party doesn't care about the NHS because they send their own families to private health, all that is now coming back. And the types of letters that people are getting are really angry, and they're also suffused with, sometimes with violence. So that whole theme that was unleashed in Brexit, and let's face it, stoked up by Dominic about division, has now come back again and is turned in on the Tory MPs, who some of whom are quite frightened. Some of the new ones haven't seen it before and are very unnerved by it. So I can't see how this is going to end at the moment, but it's still very much high wire because of the level of abuse and of correspondence that the MPs are getting that is influencing them to take a stand. But when you face that off with Boris's conviction that he needs Dominic to pull this off, I can't see yet how this ends.
Okay, thank you, Amber. That's fascinating. Before we get to the Q&A, and let me remind you that there's a chat function where you can put your questions in. It would be great if we could get some questions for you that I can put to the panel. I'm going to go to Wolf, who's going to give us an international perspective and take it beyond these borders. Wolf, give us your take on the themes around the world this week.
Okay, I will focus a bit more on terms of crisis management here, but the public health crisis management, not the political crisis management. We have heard in one of the previous calls, we were talking about South Korea. There are some staggering data coming out there. As you remember, at the beginning of May, one party goer went out in the nightclub area of Seoul, managed to spread around the virus. Well, how many? One single person so far, 247 cases, one person, one night out. What is even more staggering when is how the South Korean authorities managed to do that. They managed to trace this 247 by doing 83,000 tests, 83,000 tests for to chase one single person infection. And out of these 83,000 tests, 30% actually were asymptomatic. How they did that is contact credit cards tracing, SMS contacting, GPS tracing, and so on. So the whole package. Why I'm saying all of this? Just to show you how difficult and what it requires to try to trace and isolate once you have restarted activities, and how much damage one single person can do in a country that managed the crisis very well. Bringing it a bit closer to home, I think there are a couple of countries' stories which I think they're very interesting in terms of how they manage well the stories. And these are a bit very different countries, from Denmark to Greece. Both of them, they took a quick action. Both of them, they implemented it well. The communication was solid, and they managed now to get out of the crisis. They've reopened schools, they've reopened all sorts of activities. Greece is aiming to reopen the borders on the 15th of June. So we have two very different countries here. You know, Greece, where I think nobody was expecting the Greek government to manage this properly. You know, the health system was devastated by the financial crisis. Not a country known for public obedience, not a country known for good governance standards. They manage it very well. They closed the borders, they put a lockdown 2 weeks before they had the first dead person. That is what really helped there. To bring into context, in the UK, the restrictions were implemented when we were already having around 25, 30 dead people per day. Just to put things into perspective. In Denmark, they implemented lockdown, while the same day that year, 70,000 people went to Cheltenham to the race course festival. So clearly here, if there is a lesson learned, is moving quickly really made the difference. The other data point, which I think is interesting, and is somewhat connected to what Jim was talking about earlier, loss of debt, actually, just in the last 24 hours, we are creating more debt. Japan just launched a new stimulus package of $1.1 trillion. In Brussels, they're launching a new initiative worth 750 billion euros. But also there is another story, which I think is equally interesting. People are not spending. We were looking at savings in Europe, done since the lockdown started, and there is a huge amount of savings going on. Just to throw you some numbers to put things into perspective, in France in March, bank deposit increased by 20 billion euros. On average, is less than 4 billion for a month. In Italy, it increased by 16 billion in March alone. On average, is a 3.5 billion for a month. In Spain, same story, they saved 10 billion euros, on average is 2.3. In the UK, in March, the deposit went up by 13 billion pounds, which is one of the record figures according to the Bank of England. So there is a huge amount of savings going on. And the only country that it goes against this trend is Germany, because what the Germans do when there is a crisis, they go cash, they like their cash, they don't like credit cards and so on. So in Germany, the amount of cash circulating in the economy actually increased by 40 billion in the first 5 months of this year. But that is a typical German behavior. You run to the ATM machine when the crisis comes. We saw that in the 2008 financial crisis and later in the Eurozone crisis. So regardless of whether you keep it in cash under the mattress or you keep it in your bank account, clearly there is a huge issue of confidence of customers here and private citizen, which, and if we keep going with this kind of rates of saving, by the end of the year, we would have 400 billion euros of extra savings in the Europe, which is around 3% of EU GDP, which is certainly a very significant amount of money there. Final point from me, in continental Europe, so Italy will start on the 3rd of June, Greece on the 15th of June, Spain, a huge U-turn by Prime Minister Sanchez, now has been forced to announce the border will be reopened on the 1st of July. Germany, the reopening is already up and running. They are aiming to complete on the 15th of June. Again, in none of this country, there isn't a credible testing, tracing, tracking, isolating system in place. It's mainly done because of economic reason and obviously entails a significant risk in some countries more than other. And let me stop it there. Thank you.
Thank you, Wolf. That was great. And again, just to remind you, please bring your questions through on the chat function. That would be great if you do. But Amber and Andrew, let's sort of try and take this head on. Margaret Thatcher's government famously went through the floor in terms of its polling and ratings and then went on to win, you know, three general elections. I remember in the government, Andrew, you and I were part of, and Amber, you were part of too, when we announced the Leveson inquiry, we had two solid years of media just saying that we were the worst government ever, that effectively we were corrupt, we didn't believe in free speech, and it was endless and remorseless, and went on to win the 2015 election. Is there a danger that we are basically too close to this and think it's more significant than it is to, for a government that is 6 months in? So Amber, let's start with you and then Andrew.
Well, that is exactly what Boris will be saying, what you've just said, is that he's only 6 months in, we can weather this storm and come back in a year or two's time, back to these high ratings that we were at before. And of course, he may be right, but he may be wrong. And there are plenty of other examples when this sort of huge decline, as Andrew has set up, is very difficult to recover from. So MPs, Conservative MPs, particularly in marginal seats, will be very anxious because you may recover, the Conservative Party may recover this, it may not. And the other thing I would add is that it's pretty unpleasant for Conservative MPs, for any MPs, to be on the receiving end of huge amounts of hate. And that's what they're getting at the moment. All this hate, all this, you know, one rule for you, one rule for us, how dare you, all that. And, you know, it's quite difficult holding the line as an MP if that's what you're getting, if actually you quite sympathise with the people who are saying this.
And Andrew, you and I worked very closely with Lynton Crosby, and his big lesson was that the one thing people can't stand is politicians who say one thing and do another. Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's too soon to tell what the lasting impact is. The reason why this matters is that it feels like a glimpse into the soul of the Conservative Party. It feels like a revelation of its character and its value. It's likely to have a more enduring impact than a passing policy issue or something like Leveson, which was a very controversial press across, but didn't especially care. This is about trust and believability and integrity and democracy. So once people have lodged that view, very difficult to get people to reevaluate and persuade them that actually they've got this one wrong.
And Amber, you've directly been in a situation where people perhaps didn't understand the full context of what was going on. There was a subsequent inquiry, what happened about the immigration and all that kind of thing, that found that basically you had not been brilliantly treated during it, but you went. And a lot of people in these situations, when they're confronted by the reality and the impact of stuff, say, I'm going to stand aside. What do you think of seeing somebody who's just like, I refuse, even though I can see 20, 30% knocked off popularity ratings and that kind of thing?
Yes, I do find it pretty irritating, shall I say, Craig. I mean, it reveals the sort of selfishness of Dominic Cummings in his approach, and that people can see as well. They can see he's not even trying to hide it. His lack of apology, his lack of contrition, and the fact that he is more important not only than the party's 10-point lead, or the Boris Johnson's 10-point lead, but also than good government. I mean, it's patently obvious that the government's been doing this, Dominic Cummings, for the past few days, and he's putting his survival above anybody else's. And the way also the cabinet have been obliged to go out, most of them, and say, you know, he's a fantastic man, I just think it goes to what Andrew was just saying. It goes to implausibility, which could last in people's views of the party.
Okay, that's fascinating. And let's just, while we're sticking on this subject, David Tyler has come through and is asking the question and saying, Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings have ridden into power on the back of what they sold as being anti-idealistic policies, both in the Brexit referendum and the December election. Will the public now question the ultra-hard Brexit policies being pursued by the Johnson government as its cloth wears off? David, I think you might be a bit hopeful there, but Amber, let's start with you.
No, I'm afraid I think there's a different interpretation, rather sadder to interpret from this, which is they are not going to be knocked off their perch in terms of their direction and in terms of their commitment to having any sort of Brexit, and the hard Brexit is just as acceptable as far as they're concerned. As long as they don't have more than 40 Conservative MPs rebelling, then they can indeed carry on with impunity, which is what I fully expect them to do.
And Andrew, this actually looks like a sign of how prepared they are to dig in and stick to their guns, rather than actually that's something that they're going to bend over.
Yes, very much so. Is they going to respond when they see the ratings collapse in the way that they have here, and on such a crucial life and death issue with the coronavirus? And on Brexit, which is the, you know, the defining belief of Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson.
Okay. So look, I'm going to turn to you now, Jim, because I want to try and unpack some of the economic stuff. And you've been at the forefront of commentary on economics during all of this. I'm going to have another go on the debt question. Can you simply explain to me why it is okay for the world to take on trillions of dollars worth of debt, the government here to take on hundreds of billions of debt, and it not be the problem that we thought it was just a few years ago?
My honest answer is no, I can't. But let me follow up with three comments, which have aspects of contradictory nature. But again, I'll end up in the sort of spirit of never letting a crisis go to waste. I mean, the first one is stating the obvious. The economy has collapsed because the government chose to shut the economy down. And so there is some sort of moral societal obligation to try and support things from having been even worse, particularly on the employee side, hence the, I think, wisdom of the sort of Germanic style furloughing scheme. And if they wouldn't have done that, I'm not quite sure whether the societal response would have been as stable and as supportive as it has. So in that sense, they haven't really had any choice than to create the debt. I would add, as part of this first comment, something you touched to me in advance of this, and others have. Having chaired an independent review into antimicrobial resistance separately from my time in government for David Cameron, although I ended up completing it while I was still in government, not only does that sort of raise much broader issues about, which I think relate to some of the issues that are tangential to what Andrew and Amber were saying, in trust of the British system. You know, at the time of our review, in fact, because of it, preparedness for antimicrobial resistance and pandemics were on the country's national risk register, and something that this country was holding its head up proudly in talking about all over the world, including at the G20, and it was because of UK efforts, it got onto the G20 agenda. I played myself a big role in that. And therefore, you know, there's an important thing about whether our system delivers just a lot of hot air or actual material reality in terms of following through with action and words. Second thing to say in that regard, even though I joined the government of Cameron and Osborne as a Treasury Minister, as Amber would know, at times I try to question the scale of the emphasis on debt reduction. That there's, you know, debt reduction in its own right doesn't really serve a lot of purpose, as we see in the middle of the problems of the Eurozone and Italy. Italy's had no nominal GDP growth since the Euro started. And so, yes, there's all sorts of structural problems underlying Italy's debt, but it doesn't help if you don't get any nominal GDP growth. Hence why I suggested one of the right initiatives to do here is to do something to try and increase the probability of significant positive nominal GDP growth, or otherwise you've got absolutely no chance of getting debt down without shrinking the economy even more. And I think thinking about a framework in that sense is much more sensible. The third thing, which I think gets to the heart of what you're really coming back to, and I would have thought the right way to present a post-COVID fiscal framework, in addition to the direct increased probability of boosting nominal GDP, it gives the government's advisors, or it would do at least, some indication as to when might be the point you want to start slowing down the increase in government spending and or raising taxes, away from just obsessing on these ginormous numbers that fiscal deficits are. But unless you do that, the government of the day will end up making mistakes.
So early on in this crisis, Jim, I thought you were actually quite brave in terms of coming out and speaking about the extent to which the economy was going to be damaged and your worries around that, and perhaps things could be structured differently.
Yeah.
In many ways, this has been framed as epidemiologists versus economists, and it's epidemiologists 10, economists nil.
Hilarious.
Have won the argument completely, and economists have not been able to push through and say maybe we could have structured this differently. Do you still feel that this wasn't structured as brilliantly as it could have been, and we could have done more to structure it in a way that would have protected the economy?
Without doubt. And what I find slightly baffling, again linked to be candid, it shows again, something that sort of should bother one is essentially we've had the same political party running the country for, what is it now, 11 years, but with under three different leaders. How aspects of how the thinking can be on some really important structural issues. You know, one of the things that was, I think, relatively unique about the AMR review I led, and amongst the many reasons why I say it was probably the most interesting thing I've ever done, is we included all sorts of inputs and advice from infectious disease modellers about infection disease. So we approached it as an economic and finance issue, but incorporated things we didn't know about. And clearly at the start of this, and it's easy for me to say these things because, of course, they had to act with speed, but to not set up a framework straight away to consider what would be the economic consequence of X, Y, and Z, which, by, you know, you could level the same accusation at other countries, but it's sort of ludicrous given some of the framework that have been around some of those things, in my view. And you could build a sort of three-dimensional optimization model that would be basically telling you what variants of lockdown would likely have the economic consequence or not, and so on. Same as, by the way, I would also add, as much as I welcome the furloughing scheme, it should have had much more direct linkage to the loan programme, because what we have seen, and it's growing by the week, and hence why the Treasury is right to consider play it. But the amount of gaming that's going on with the furloughing scheme is almost definitely huge. Because they're not directly linked. If you're going to pursue a loan program, it should have been contingent to companies that would have some kind of commitments in the future. The first thing they're going to do is, when furloughing is not over, is to just basically get rid of everybody.
So Amber and Wolf, what Jim is saying is actually, to me, sounds quite challenging for a lot of politicians, in the sense that politicians have basically felt themselves unable to say, look, we could have done it differently, and we might not have had to listen to the health thing to the extent that we have done, and shut the economy down to the extent we have. And probably lurking behind that is concerns about how the public would react and treat them. Is that fair to say, Amber? And then Wolf, I'll come to you.
Yes, I think that is fair to say. I mean, listening to Jim, I can't help but agree, but he will know as well that government only has so much bandwidth. And I think that what they were doing when they put the furloughing scheme in place is just buying time to try to have that moment to pause to work out what the next step was. And, you know, to their credit, they managed to amend the furloughing scheme to be more effective and then introduce the self-employment. So they were having to think and act on the go, and there wasn't anywhere near enough early planning of the three-dimension optimization model, which we all like to have in readiness for various issues. Given that this happened sort of on such a kind of young cabinet as well, I don't think there was any capacity to do that, even though it would have been great.
That sounds quite concerning. Wolf, are we seeing this internationally as well? Do you think Britain is unusual in this, or actually are we seeing this around the world?
What I think has been a very, very unusual year from day one has been the role of the politicians. We discussed that in previous calls, these daily press conferences with politicians involved, various ministers who don't really know what they're going to say, and so on. In most of the continental European countries, when these press briefings were done by scientists, by people actually who understand the matter. We were talking about data, and we're trying to stay away from the political debate. So here has been political from day one. I was looking at, you know, again, looking at the experience of Greece. What Prime Minister Mitsotakis did, he put the chief epidemiologist in charge, this unknown figure, a very humble man, a man who goes to church every Sunday, he's got five kids, and suddenly became a rock star because he was able to explain pretty much like Merkel did to the Germans what their ratio is. And also Mitsotakis never tried to use the scientists to gain political coverage, which is again another thing that we have seen happening in this country in multiple occasions. So I think it's a very mixed bag here. I don't think there is a clear-cut solution. Every country has done it in kind of different ways. But certainly also the idea of protecting the economy is a bit tricky, because if you look at the experience of Sweden, everybody was talking about, look, they didn't do the lockdown, they do it to protect the economy, and blah, 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 blah. Well, actually, Denmark, they did a lockdown. The GDP contraction expected in Denmark is around 5.5% of GDP. In Sweden will be higher. Partially it could be due because of the structure of the economy. But so again, every country has its own story. For me, when I look at the past experiences in continental Europe, I compare to what has been here. Here has been political from day one. And that was a mistake.
So, Andrew, this theme is being developed by some of the people in terms of the questions that are coming through. Kyne Levingston says, neither media or government seem to be willing to have grown-up discussions with the public, i.e. actions and consequences and trade-offs. Can we get back to a more adult public debate? And if so, how? And I know that this is something that you've been thinking about actually for a long time, is do people actually have honest discussions with the public because they're afraid that if they do, they won't like it?
I think that's true. Most politicians are very fearful of sharing unpalatable truths with voters. They think that what people want is politicians who will tell them what they want to hear and bring easy, costly solutions and to avoid conversations with the electorate, in which the point they're having to make is, we don't really know the answer to this one, there is no easy answer, there are trade-offs to be had here. Even though I think most voters would relish politicians who do that, and certainly with something like the coronavirus, where it's self-evident to most people that there isn't a neat, easy, painless way, risk-free way, of balancing on one hand the health issues and on the other hand the economic damage. The polling does tell us that at the beginning of the lockdown, people were, for understandable reasons, very worried about getting ill, and there's had a number of people worried about their own health has steeply declined from around 70% to around 40%. And the more people are worried less about their health, and the more they felt they no longer need to worry about there being enough food in the supermarkets and so on, the more worried they're becoming about the economy. I think the public are now really and wanting to have that conversation. And one of the consequences of the last few days is that the government has, with far fewer people now wanting to give the government the benefit, when they hear talking to them and asserting things to them about policy of coming out of the lockdown.
Okay, Andrew is asking a question here. Do you think that the way that the crisis has been handled, both in terms of actions taken as well as messaging, for example, the handling of Cummings and others, will start the move away from soundbite populist politics? I ask as the handling of the crisis in other countries has been best handled by technocratic leaders. So, Amber, do you think this is going to lead to a bit more grown-up, less infantilized politics?
No, I don't really. I think that they're just going to try and do it a bit better. But I very much agree with what Andrew was saying about the need for being more upfront about the trade-offs that have to take place. And I think that they're reaching for that with the messaging, with stay alert and common sense. But I think it's all got muddied up now because of the whole Dominic Cummings event. And the fact that with Dominic Cummings, there's this ongoing debate about did he break the law, the lockdown, you know, whatever you care to interpret, just shows that people are in a bit of a muddle. And thinking about Wolf's points about Greece and about Spain particularly, their lockdown was completely different to ours. Our lockdown basically had very little legislation in it. People get very confused, but all the police could do, obviously, is enforce the law. And all the law did was restrict travel. They had nothing to do with anything else. The rest of it was just government advice. And our lockdown is much, much weaker than Greece's, for instance, and than Italy's. And it's just a completely different mindset here. While Boris has been trying to limit his opposition to the nanny state, but still try and do the right thing in terms of the lockdown. And I think that's led to confusing messages.
And Jim, I just want to come at this from the policy's perspective, because you're obviously a very seriously interested in how do you lay out policy, how do you do big grown-up things in order to make sure that things are better. Do you get frustrated by the level of the debate and the way it goes?
I'm also sympathetic. I think Amber made a very good point in response to what I said, and I should have made that even clearer. You know, and having been 17 months, an extensive 17 months in government, I'm aware, you know, you have to deal with the moment, right? So it's easy for me to conceptualise about the rights and wrongs, but people have to adjust to what happened. However, and there's lessons for beyond, I think I use the phrase machine, there's lessons for aspects of civil service operations as well from all of this. But before I get onto that, and I'm sort of indirectly coming to answer you, that as I discussed widely in last weekend's media, as most of us on an individual basis experience, why on earth didn't we lock down 2 weeks before? If it was supposedly being so aware of the sort of connection with the people, notwithstanding this ridiculous nonsense with Dominic Cummings, why didn't we lock down 2 weeks before? Because we almost definitely would have been in a considerably different position than we are now. And the answers to that will still yet to be determined, but they probably related to some weird cousins of we're special because, you know, we've got a good health system and we won't be affected like the Italians and blah, 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 and all sorts of very strange things. Away from the politicians, and I'm going to pick on Public Health England, I'm afraid, which I have my own experiences from because of the AMR review, why on earth were they not forced or somehow being led to be much more open about getting this testing stuff going way earlier? Utter bureaucratic incompetence, in my view. And, you know, we need to make sure, which is why I take it right back to the initial points I made. If you look at sort of classic indicators about sustainable development, shared prosperity and productivity, the UK is badly lacking behind and has been for a long time. And at the core of why many of these countries have done well, it links to some of those indicators, is issues to, in some ways, simple things like technology. Well, and you see it's at the extreme here. On the good side is we have two of our brilliant universities at the forefront of global vaccine development, and yet we don't have any R&D or technology that seems to be really capable of helping all our own people. The reason why South Korea scores so highly in these kind of indicators, and by the way, this is a country that when I first started working had the average GDP per capita of an African country, but is now that of a typical European G7 country, is that everybody in South Korea has access and uses all their technology. Whereas we can't even have a testing system in a country like ours. It is really bothering. And we need to deal with these issues on a fundamental basis, because this is not going to be the last crisis that happens coming out of this kind of area.
And on that point, Wolf, I was interested in what you were saying was the sheer extent of what South Korea was doing in order to track and trace, and also to, you know, basically crossing the line of what a lot of Western democracies might find in terms of how people's privacy is treated and that kind of thing. And yet we are seeing in this country the government saying we're going to open shops on June the 15th, that we're going to do all this stuff. Do you feel that they are just making it up as they go along, or do they actually have enough basis in reality to do that and understand that what they're doing?
It is clear that a robust system of testing, tracking, tracing is not in place in the UK, and arguably is not in place in most of the other European countries, including Italy, despite all the dead and so on. The potential exception there is Germany, where they manage, because they can do more than 1 million tests per week. The health system is working very well at a local level. We discussed this at the last week, so that is why they were able to detect immediately an outbreak in the meat packaging industry and isolate people. So it's the technology, is the kind of the bureaucratic system that you have in place, is how you deliver health system. For example, is about communication. There is all sorts of experiences. You know, Greece, again, I'm sorry I'm banging about Greece here. They managed to put together an SMS system that people, when they were leaving their house, they would have to send an SMS, and they would have to send an SMS once they were returning to their house. This was not just to control whether you were in or out, but also that allowed Greece to collect a huge amount of data about movement of individuals, which became very useful the moment in which you were starting to lift the restriction here. So that, and what is also interesting, in the last few weeks, the whole idea of using technology application actually in Europe has lost quite a bit of salience. More and more, they are talking about human tracing because of privacy issue, because this application, they're not talking to each other, it's taking time to test them. Italy is supposed to open the borders on the 3rd of June. We are going to start testing the application on the 1st of June in three regions. There are other 17 regions there. So the whole technology story here, very different from what Jim was talking about in South Korea, is still half work and actually is losing salience with the passing of the crisis.
And Amber and Andrew, we saw something come. I'm going to ask the question, and Amber, then you come on the point. We saw very clearly something straight out of a comms director's playbook on Sunday when there was a schools announcement, then they rushed forward the shops opening. Should we be worried that actually the protection of Dominic Cummings is actually driving forward lockdown easing policy or not? Amber and then Andrew.
Well, first of all, I think it is driving forward lockdown policy. But from what I know, listening to the news and looking at other countries and listening to Wolf, is that we quite need to open up our lockdown. And a lot of people are actually nervous about emerging from their lockdown status. And it may be that this will, you know, give people confidence that they can do so, and it might be time to do so. But could I also just add a question to Wolf, which is that listening to your point about South Korea and its impact of one guy going around a number of discos and having that impact and that reach and it being pulled in only because of the good test, track and trace, and listening also to your points about the fact that Italy and other countries in Europe are now beginning to open up without any test, track and trace, one can only conclude that if people open up and start going to discos, it's going to be very ugly.
It's already getting very ugly, also because the idea, you know, we were discussing before about talking to people as individuals. The problem is the moment you start moving the restriction, we haven't seen much adult behavior in all sorts of countries, and it's not just the picture you've seen in the UK during the weekend. In Italy, in Milan, they had to stop selling alcohol after 7 o'clock in the evening. They had to put this new measure because of what they saw happening as soon as the restrictions were lifted there. Risk of a second wave, the risk of outbreaks is very, very high. In Korea, there is a new outbreak. Now is in an e-commerce center. They shut it down completely. They were able to do 4,000 tests and so on. We have seen outbreaks in China at the border with Russia. There they can manage these in ways that here politically is unfeasible. We cannot even think about that. But the risk of a second wave, the risk of outbreaks, the risk of having to roll back to reintroduce curbs and restriction is certainly very high because the technology and the behavior of individuals is not up for standards.
Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's back to the question of competence. I think the legacy of the kinds of errors is that people will be increasingly sceptical, people will wonder about motives for the things that come to time, and they'll be wondering whether they're really true. And behind this, there's a competence issue, and the government's had its struggle so far to deliver on what's promised in terms of testing, and whether it actually has the capability, as Wolf was just talking about in other countries, the capability to deliver a whack-a-mole strategy, which is what is bound up in the lifting of the lockdown, where you're able to crack down on rates of where it's occurring. If you don't have enough tests to do that, we'll split very fast in terms of the scale of tests in Germany and South Korea, and that seems to be the common thread here. Even though it's a central part of this right from the beginning, here we are kind of 10 weeks later, the government still actually hasn't fixed the issue of testing. So you know, these competence questions are, I think, voters of people are forgiving and quite willing to give the government benefit of the doubt. What's changing because of the Cummings issue is people have lost that sympathy, and so the government's competence and delivery is going to be real scrutiny.
Jim, very specific question here, which is, can you talk about the benefits of getting an insurance model going to help business get back on its feet or deal with catastrophes like this in the future?
Probably not. I'm no great insurance expert. You know, I touched on it earlier. I linked to a lot of what has been touched on by others. Yeah, I think we need to learn a lot from other places, and think think more about some kind of version, let me call it a stakeholder economy, instead of this, you know, the extreme end of the Anglo-Saxon shareholder maximization economy. And business itself, you know, I'm involved in some pretty interesting work via my role as chair in Chatham House, but also separately about, we move to a world where business itself has to be involved in optimizing its goals, rather than just particularly publicly quoted business and just pure maximization of profit. Because at the end of the day, a lot of this crisis at its core, as it will be to future infectious diseases, it's about can we prepare for these kind of societal challenges, but can we have a system where there is more collective interest in trying to stop market failures?
Right.
And you know, one way of thinking of this is we're going through a classic market failure, and everybody, it's not just you know, I'm feeling irritated with myself that in how I've answered a lot of your other questions, I'm just basically criticizing government, which I'm not really trying to do that. I do think certain, particularly parts of the Treasury response, specifically on furloughing, were really good. But, you know, business itself often still sort of behaves as though it's in a completely detached world from the rest of normal human beings. And, you know, business has got to find a better way of making capitalism work better and having more skin in the game other than just its quarterly bottom line.
Okay, look, we're into the final 2 minutes of the call. I found this a fascinating discussion, but I also found it quite depressing this week. Again, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this might have as well. I'm going to give you all just like literally just 20 seconds. Give us a reason to feel optimistic this week. And Wolf, let's start with you. 20 seconds.
Well, in Brussels, finally, apparently, that we're going to be issuing a joint debt and do fiscal transfer. So thanks to the Macron-Merkel deal, this potentially is becoming reality, is something that no meaning the side of the British press seems to appreciate. I think is a big deal. They break 2 times ago. We are not there. It will take time to get it done, but it's a major development in terms of the European Union.
Amber.
The best way for the Prime Minister to save Dominic Cummings, which is what he wants to do, is to have a really big, ambitious offer for the future. I know work is going on that, but the sooner they do it, the more eye-catching it is, the better result for him holding on to his advisor, and the better result for us all.
Andrew, a sentence from you. That wasn't very optimistic. Okay, Jim.
I agree with Amber and Wolfgang. I think those are two things that are happening. And despite the tone of some of my answers, you know, I'm hugely influenced in my own career in never letting a crisis go to waste. And some good can come of this. My own addition to that is, notwithstanding the problems of global cooperation, the things going on between the private sector and the pharmaceutical space is absolutely fantastic. Fantastic.
Well, good. It's now 12:30, so we've come to the end of the call. Another fantastic panel. Next week, we are going to have Bill Bratton, who ran New York Police Department and LA Police Department, coming on. So it's going to be another great panel next week, but this week's panel was amazing too. And I would like to thank Jim O'Neill, Amber Rudd, Andrew Cooper, and Wolfgang O'Piccoli for another brilliant discussion. And I'll look forward to seeing you next week. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Goodbye. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you.